Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We begin every day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019, where he assured his father that it would be all right. And what we now know is that not only was it not all right for Colonel Vindman, not all right for his twin brother, but he's actually asked for early retirement because of the kind of harassment that happened under the Trump administration. I want you to hear the voice of a patriot. You will hear it every day between now and November of 2020. Keep that voice in your head when you decide to exercise the franchise. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I read this article at The Nation, and it was about Amazon, and it was about monopolies. And suddenly I realized I've got to learn more about monopolies. I heard Elizabeth Warren talk about them, but I really wasn't paying much attention to it. And so I started looking around for more content on the monopoly theme. And to some extent, this week is going to be dedicated to everything you wanted to know about monopolies, but didn't even know to ask. Joining me right now is a history professor and a journalism professor at Columbia, Richard John. He is a historian who specializes in the history of business, technology, communications, and American political development. He has written and taught a lot about capitalism and the history of communications. Richard, before we get into the monopoly thing, I did want to touch on an article that you had also been discussing, and it was about the United States Postal Service. And you've written a book about the United States Postal Service. There's such pressure now on the United States Postal Service, not only to survive, but to be there for the November election. We're talking about mail-in ballots. We're talking about a huge spike in absentee ballots. We're talking about everyone looking for a way of exercising the franchise without physically showing up. And that means the Postal Service. So as we look at this November election, how ready is the USPS for the kind of responsibility that they're going to be maybe handed, given the fact that we have been starving that beast since 2006?
Well, the USPS delivers about half the world's mail. It's been delivering the mail for a long time. And in fact, every American voted by mail, that's not going to be a huge spike in postal volume. So if the institution is permitted to work as it should, the institution will be able to respond just as it has in so many ways in the past. Questions remain about political interference with postal balloting, but those are issues that do not directly affect the operation of the institution itself.
Are you not worried? Let me share with you my concerns. Ryan McCarthy from ProPublica came on the air with me, and he decided to spend a year looking at the Postal Service as it exists today. And he also went to a lot of the states that have been doing, you know, vote by mail for years. So they've developed the mail muscle, as I would say. And what he discovered was kind of shocking. What he discovered was that because they've been doing this for so long, they know exactly how the Postal Service works. They know its strengths and their weaknesses. So one of the things one of the states does is right before the deadline, they are allowed into these big warehouses and postal offices, and they do actual sweeps where they go looking for ballots because they know that sometimes they can get lost or they can get bundled. They began to realize that they've closed warehouses. So what used to be a warehouse, for example, maybe let's say in the state of Illinois, is now a warehouse in the state of Wisconsin because they consolidated. So knowing that there has been a real financial push on the Postal Service because it isn't able to necessarily meet the same demands as it did in the past, You're not concerned about suddenly this inundation of so many people voting by mail at a time where the Postal Service feels like it's a little more of a skeleton operation than it was in the past.
The post office is able to handle holiday mail. The post office is able to handle big upswings of mail when there's some kind of natural disaster. I'm not concerned about the institution itself. Now, if there's going to be outside manipulation of the institution, as your colleague right. is mentioning, that's another question altogether. But the institution itself, there's civil service protections. There's a dedicated workforce. It's a huge workforce, almost half a million. And they can meet the challenge of the day.
All right. Well, my concern is there's so much riding on this election. So many people, because of the pandemic, are so concerned about actually, you know, physically showing up to vote, that there is this real assumption that the post office is the sort of solution for all of us, which to a large extent, historically, I would totally agree with. I'm just worried because it's, you know, under such financial pressure, it hasn't been able to meet some of its own, you know, we can turn around first class mail within so many days, and they haven't necessarily been able to do that. But I will feel better having talked to you. So now let's talk a little bit about why I reached out to you, because this is definitely going to be Monopoly Week. You did an interview on C-SPAN that was entitled Anti-Monopoly Laws, Attitudes Past and Present. And I want to know a little bit about the history of my country and the idea of this sort of anti-monopoly footprint that really originated with people like Thomas Paine. I mean, I'm reading your piece going, Thomas Paine wrote this? I could be saying this today. And I was just so shocked because I'll be honest with you, I'm ticked off. How come no one ever taught me this, Richard?
Mm-hmm. Well, anti-monopoly is as American as apple pie. Founders of the United States were all anti-monopolists, and that would include Alexander Hamilton. And they were anti-monopolists for a simple reason. The monopoly they feared the most was British commerce, British government policy that was restricting where American goods could go in an international, or today we'd call it global, economy. And so the hatred toward monopoly was intense, and it was bound up with not only the East India Company, which was the organization that trying to land the tea in Boston, led to the Boston Tea Party, but with the whole framework of British commercial restrictions. And those restrictions angered many, or at least it was seen as a threat, and that's a distinction. Some Americans, particularly in the South, were comfortable with British commercial regulations. And in fact, they talked about reinstating them after the war because they wanted to continue to export agricultural staples to Britain as they'd done before. But everyone knew that monopoly was political, that monopoly was buttressed by law and at the end at the point of a gun, and that it was a potential threat to the independence of the fledgling republic.
So that's how we started. When I look at where we are today, I feel like we don't feel as threatened where I think we should with the idea of monopolies. We see the efficiency. We see the cost savings. I mean, as much as I, you know, hate Amazon, there is some virtue to one click. There's a lot of reasons to sort of not like the potential of what this bigness means. But where did we sort of begin to make the shift? What was the sort of history of our anti-monopoly sort of beginnings? And when do we begin to sort of look at big business as an asset and not a threat? That this concentration of economic power wasn't just economic, but that it would ultimately become political.
So Arnie, you raise a couple of very good issues. One is anti-monopoly about low cost? Is anti-monopoly about corporations that are somehow providing us with cheap goods, or alternatively, providing us with goods that are more expensive? So that's an economic issue. Those issues have become paramount following the rise of neoclassical economics in the 20th century, really since the Second World War. So that's a relatively short period of time in the history of a tradition that goes right back to the founders, to Thomas Jefferson, to Alexander Hamilton, to Thomas Paine, and so on. In the 19th century, the long 19th century, say from the founding of the country up through the First World War, anti-monopoly was perceived primarily as a political issue. That is to say, in the 1820s and 30s, businessmen were concerned that certain favored individuals, often those with political clout and wealth and social prestige, were able to get special privileges. They were able to get a charter for a bank or some sort of internal improvement that was not available to others. Okay. That was perceived as offensive. It was perceived as illegitimate. It was perceived as politically dangerous. That was the definition of special privilege. So in order to challenge special privilege, equal rights. Everyone should be able to set up a bank. Everyone should be able to set up a telegraph company or some kind of corporation. And, mm-hmm. and it, so the issue wasn't so much big and small. The issue was access. Fast forward.
They wanted a level playing field.
Okay. And that's really important for understanding the anti-monopoly impulse, let's say, in the 1830s. And that extended to land. Everyone should have access to land. Level playing field. 1870s and 80s, the coming of railroad, telegraph, then oil, robber barons, so-called, they were a threat because they were constricting opportunity. And they were not providing as many facilities as they should, and they were discriminating in their pricing. And so, in fact, at that moment in time, anti-monopolists contended, look, the oceans are available to everyone, but the rights of way for railroads are not, so we need more railroads. We need bigger railroads. We need more powerful railroads. And then the argument was, well, maybe the government should regulate them or even take them over. The same logic applied with the telegraph. So it wasn't a small as beautiful argument at all. If you're a farmer in Iowa, you want more ways to bring your crops to market. And if more ways implied that you're going to have bigger railroads, that's fine. If the rates are low and there's no perception of political jugglery. In fact, the railroads were seen as overgrown proprietorships, and the robber baron. Think of the robber barons in Germany. What did they do? They taxed the traffic going up and down the Rhine. And by the way, this last thing I'll say about robber barons: you had to be pretty erudite to call a businessman a robber baron. You had to know some medieval German history. So, in fact, that critique started with Charles Francis Adams and other very well-respected, influential, kind of East Coast Harvard graduates who were outraged at these upstarts who were manipulating financial markets and manipulating channels of commerce.
So when you mentioned railroad, I remember, you know, I live in the state of New Hampshire, and the railroads own the legislature in New Hampshire. Everybody kind of knew that.
Correct.
And if something about that concentration of power and then the ownership of the political power isn't toxic, I don't know what is. So when did we begin to sort of move away from thinking that was toxic and started almost accepting the idea that we needed to look at big as I point out, you know, more efficient, cheaper opportunity. I mean, like, you know, Walmart or Amazon or whatever. When did we devolve into looking only at price and not at power?
The answer to that question is a complicated one because efficiency, well-run infrastructure was aligned with reform impulses. Farmers who wanted to get their goods to market. You have one of the greatest utopian novels ever written by Edward Bellamy, 1880s. He envisions the nationalization of the entire economy out of a disgust with the robber barons, with the manipulation of legislatures. Henry George, writing Progress and Poverty, 1879, has a similar vision. And for him, the enemy, the villain, the single force that needed to be supplanted were landowners, urban landowners, rural landowners, and he's thinking of the manipulation of legislatures by the railroad barons in the 1860s and 1870s. So that impulse carries through into the 19-aughts and teens. We had a presidential election in 1912 that hinged on the monopoly issue, and it's fascinating. Each of the major candidates took a position. Teddy Roosevelt was in favor of regulated monopoly. Woodrow Wilson, regulated competition. So it's at this time that you begin to get the argument that small is beautiful. Louis Brandeis, who is working closely with Wilson, helping to write position papers, end up on the Supreme Court. He'd been involved in litigation with railroads and with other firms, antitrust litigation, and he was convinced that firms could get too big and they would not be efficient and they would use their political power to undermine smaller firms. And that's at the moment.
Sounds pretty good to me.
With the Wilsonian moment. And by the way, that was a position that was also congenial to Herbert Hoover, who had a very similar vision in the 19-teens and 20s, that businesses could get too big, that if businesses were too big, then they would almost by necessity have to get involved with the political process, and they would use their power to discriminate against small firms. And that was a widely perceived danger. The problem was, what do you do about it? If you just set up a regulatory agency, well, you can set up a regulatory agency, the Federal Trade Commission, or in the 1887, the Interstate Commerce Commission. But wait a minute, if the big firms can buy up the legislatures, why can't they buy up the commissions?
Oh, so, a revolving door.
Right. So that argument was very much on the table. Another alternative is simply to have penalties, to have restriction on the kinds of interlocking directorates. If you're in one corporation, you can't be in another. Or what I find to be one of the most interesting outcomes were these consent decrees that the courts negotiated in lieu of an antitrust suit, a consent decree in which a corporation would agree voluntarily to stop some business practice. So one of the first great consent decrees obliged American Telephone and Telegraph to give up the telegraph. So that's kind of interesting. Yeah. I mean, the name of the company was American Telephone and Telegraph. From the 1880s, it was supposed to coordinate the telegraph as well as the telephone. Yet it is forced by an aggressive attorney general in 1913 to give up the telegraph and therefore to, in effect, concentrate on a particular sector. And that kind of competition that is based on segmenting of industry has been very, very effective, and it's almost unknown in the history books.
Okay, so I had to ask you a question, because you mentioned something about the 1912 election, and that there were sort of two views. One was to manage competition, and the other one was to somehow manage the monopoly. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? Is it just by size? You say, okay, too big, we break you apart.
Yeah.
It's the other one. We don't care if you're too big. We just want to make sure that there's still a competitive playing field. What's the difference between the two? Do they get you very different outcomes? It sounds semantical to me, but maybe it's because I'm naive.
Well, you know, you're running for president. You come up with a platform that's different than the other fellow that's running for president. They were all fellows at that time. By the way, the socialist candidate was in favor of government ownership, right? So you have a position to their left, as it were. If you can see, you know, who's on the left? Is it regulating big business? Is that on the left? Or is it breaking up big business? Is that on the left? The more conservative position historically was we should not have big business because it's inefficient. And that was the position of Woodrow Wilson and the Southerners who were in politics. But the bright young minds coming from the Northeast, including much of the economics profession, was very skeptical of antitrust. Antitrust had not worked particularly well, and they were contending that we some sort of regulatory apparatus. And in fact, Woodrow Wilson establishes such a regulatory apparatus with the support of Brandeis, Federal Trade Commission in 1914, and the Clayton Act, which imposes additional restraints upon railroads and other big businesses, and perhaps most important of all, declares that labor is not a commodity. Because if the government gets in the business of regulating anti-competitive organizations, one organization that's going to be in the sight of the courts are labor unions. And most of the successful antitrust litigation before 1912 was litigation against labor unions. So that changes then in 1914, where labor unions get an exemption. Samuel Gompers called that the Magna Carta of American labor, that they will not be subject to the antitrust laws. And in fact, most antitrust litigation focused on relatively small businesses. Alternatives were devised in the 1920s. Laura Phillips Sawyer, you should have her on, fine historian, Harvard Business School, now at University of Georgia, has done a book on the Fair Trade League. The idea there was, let's figure out how much it costs to manufacture maple flooring or some other commodity. And then the different firms in that market will know what the appropriate costs are, and therefore they'll price appropriately. Now, in order for that coordination to occur, you have to get around antitrust, because antitrust historically had prohibited business people.
So that's not price fixing, because what you're saying, it seems, I'm listening to this.
Awfully close to the same. Right.
Exactly.
They contended it was not price fixing, but it's close. And the steel industry, the famous Gary dinners, Albert Gary, got together all the steel firms, and he contended that the best way to avoid ruinous competition, or what was called cutthroat competition, was to have an agreement about pricing. And that was considered to be a solution that would help the small firms as well as the big firms. So there's a complicated mix of ideas in the 19-teens, but that's when the modern idea that certain businesses are too big, say Standard Oil, American Tobacco, took hold. And the theorist who's the most prominently identified with that idea is Louis Brandeis. In fact, today there's a whole group of antitrust lawyers who call themselves the neo-Brandeisians.
Huh. Ken, did you want to weigh in?
The first question I had when you first mentioned anti-monopolist theory being around from the beginning of the country was, well, what do we mean by anti-monopoly? Because it's different. When the American colonies were talking about being anti-King's Charter to the West India Company or something, that is a very different thing than an economic monopoly in the industrial age in the late 19th century, when capitalism seemingly inevitably had produced larger and larger companies that, pursuing their regular ordinary business plans, would buy out other companies, would get economies of scale, it would be cheaper for them to produce goods, and then they could enact barriers to entry so nobody else could enter, and it would be hard to start off a company and compete with them. And then they start following each other and fixing prices. I mean, all of this stuff is very different
from what they thought in the very beginning in 1770. But because it was the English that you were sort of seeing as the power broker and the power control, and then right. We developed our own form of that, and that's very different when it's homegrown.
Yeah, and it sounds like to me anyway, a lot of the economy, capitalist economy in a free, unregulated market like we had in the late 19th century, seems to go that way. That monopolies are created and they take over. And if you think that's a problem, that economic power, which lets them take advantage of consumers and also lets them gain political power, and they run the country.
So Ken, that's the argument of 20th century neoclassical economists. And that was the argument of my teacher, Alfred Chandler, who was a Pulitzer Prize winning historian, the book, The Visible Hand, that the rise of the large corporation was driven by technological imperatives and market incentives, and that it was more or less inexorable beginning with the railroad. And as a historian who's interested in what people thought as well what happened on the ground, a couple of observations. One, even Chandler would acknowledge the firms got much bigger than they would have had there not been competition. And the kinds of competition that occurred, he contends, is shaped by politics. Even he would contend that. And the critics of this Chandlerian position contend that the firms got big in part in order to manipulate legislatures to hold off newcomers and in order to block certain kinds of innovation. And one of the peculiar features with the Sherman Act was that it made it illegal, the Interstate Commerce Act of 1887 was that it made it illegal to pool. In other words, to have a formal agreement in order to, in effect, divvy up the revenue that a number of railroads operating in similar markets were generating. And that increased competitive pressures. The same thing happened with the Sherman Act in 1890. So the legal infrastructure is shaping the way the businesses are operating, just as the businesses are shaping the legal infrastructure. And you're absolutely right, Ken, that industrialism is very different from what was going on in Britain in the 18th mm-hmm. century. The point of similarity that I'm trying to draw attention to is that the perception of monopoly as not just one company, but the entire British commercial system, that perception that it's cultural, it's political, it's economic, was carried over to the way contemporaries thought about railroads. And of course, when you say the economy was unregulated in the last quarter of the 19th century, that is a position that any Republican politician worth his salt would have vociferously disagreed with, because the Republican Party was the party of high tariffs, and high tariffs were a rather substantial interference in the operation of the economy, international economy. So in effect, we were establishing with high tariffs a trade system that was not that different from the trade system that the British had established in the 18th century. But you didn't want to talk about it that way because these were our jobs, our workers, our industries. So I do push back on the idea that the economy was unregulated or that we ever had laissez-faire. Those are very convenient assumptions for the apologists for big business today. But it does not serve us if we want to understand how these enormous aggregates emerged to describe the late 19th century economy in that way. I'd even go so far as to disagree that it was a gilded age, but that's a whole other question for a whole other day.
So I'm hearing this, and so here we roiled against the Brits, what they did, and then we sort of did our own version thereof. Huh? Is that the nature of capitalism?
Yes.
Is by definition, capitalism can only go in one direction. That it does want to, it does want to monopolize. It does want, you know, as much as it talks about competition, it doesn't want competition because it wants to control competition. It doesn't want new entry because new entry is more competition. So what I'm trying to figure out is there such a thing? I go back to Hillary Clinton and Clinton Care. Remember when Hillary Care? It was managed competition. That's what she was talking about with health insurance companies.
Right.
And I had my finger down my throat because I remember thinking, I'm not sure that actually works. But I guess my question is, does it work? And if you don't have managed competition, then by definition, capitalism can only go in one direction, and that is bigger, better, more in control. And ultimately, it sort of not only is an economic powerhouse, it now defines the politics of where it's located.
Capitalism has emerged, if you want to just call it a thing, has emerged differently in different countries. We had big firms earlier in the United States than we did in Britain. Big firms earlier in Germany than in France. That has to do with the rules of the game, the political economy. But the extent to which is competition the goal? Well, if you're Samuel Gompers, you want to have a closed shop. You want to have a monopoly. You don't want to have competition. You want to be able to control the terms. And in fact, they, as I mentioned, antitrust litigation was directed against workers. So it depends whose ox is being gored. And are you talking about a national economy where you're going to be concerned about industrial jobs, as the Republican Party was, or are you talking about an international economy? Democrats in New York and certain Southern Democrats, much more concerned about import-export, not so concerned about industrial jobs, they're going to be critical of those tariff laws. So it depends upon what the play of interests are, and that's as true today as it was in the 1880s when these debates first came to a head.
You know, what's so interesting to me is I'm listening to you, I keep thinking about my Republican friends who wanted to run for office because they want to treat government like a business, that we could get all these efficiencies and we would understand competition. That's what's wrong with public education. We don't have competition. Think about this. And yet there's an irony here because what you're describing is once they're in power, they want to get rid of that competition. Mm-hmm. Once they're in power, they want to become big. Once they're in power, they want to dictate the terms of everything. So in an ironic way, they complain about government with its regulation and its bigness and its setting the terms. And yet what they ultimately want to do is they want to have this sort of private version of this as long as they're in control.
Exactly. So that's a good argument for limiting aggregates of power. Barry Lynn's new book, you should have Barry Lynn on your show, talks about the system of liberty. It's coming out this September, open markets. That's an argument for relatively decentralized political economy. And that's an issue that's related to, but distinct from, this question of monopoly. Should you have, for example, a lot of different producers? Should you be sourcing your own computer chips and other goods rather than getting them from China?
Are you talking about starting over again? If we started off in Hobbesian Leviathan or something, and we're going to create things from scratch? Or are we starting with a lot of companies that already have huge amounts of capital and individuals who already have huge amounts of wealth, and having a whole lot of small companies producing everything just ain't going to happen anytime soon?
Some kind of mix between big and small. But if there were, say, requirements for national security that X, Y, and Z had to be manufactured inside the country, that would be an analog to 19th century tariff policy. Those are very major regulatory constraints that structured whole regions of the country. The region of the country we today call the Rust Belt was the region that was the beneficiary of these tariff laws. And so why is global trade, free trade, who is that benefiting? Why is that an unquestioned good?
Before you leave that subject, though, Ernie, can I just ask you, you're equating tariffs and international competition with competition in the domestic economy. And I thought that in the late 19th century, the domestic economy was much larger and the international portion of trade was smaller. It was very important for certain businesses, including protecting the steel industry, for instance. But now it's different that companies can find offshore markets, offshore producers, offshore banks to hide their money. But the kind of monopoly that the Sherman Act was geared towards, I thought, was monopolies within this country.
Of course. Yeah. It was a question as to whether it could be extended overseas, and it was extended overseas in the 1940s. But one reason that we have that very internally variegated political economy in the 1880s was because of tariff legislation that was limiting cheap imports of a whole variety of goods.
One of the things I'll never forget, when Tony Blair was the Prime Minister of England, and Tony Blair was talking to Angela, and he was just so jealous of the economy in Germany. And he was saying to Angela, how did you do this? How did you do this? And my favorite line was Angela looks at him, sort of rolls her eyes and says, Tony, we still make things in Germany. I keep hearing that in my head as I'm beginning to sort of listen to you. I'm hearing that in my head as I'm looking at, you know, Elizabeth Warren's I Have a Plan for That. And the idea of bringing it back sounds wonderful. But then again, I'm worried about bringing it back for whom? For one? For many? Will we allow competition? Or will it be friends on high that have connections to the power at the moment? So thank you so much for this amazing history lesson. This is going to be an important conversation going into 2020. Absolutely. And I think it's going to be an important conversation after we figure out how to survive the pandemic. The question is, to a large extent, we're going to be rebuilding. And then the question is, how do we rebuild? So Richard John, thank you so much. Thank you and join us again. Ciao. Bye-bye, Richard. All right. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back. Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We've had Matt Stoller on before. He has a newsletter, got to grab it. It's called Big. He had a recent piece, and I told you this is Monopoly Week on The Attitude, and it was entitled A Land of Monopolists, From Portable Toilets to Mixed Martial Arts. And I'm like, wow, I know he's a good author. And I know he wrote the book Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy, which looked at the sort of the concentration of a lot of these sort of, you know, institutions and financial institutions. But I was trying to figure out, how do you get portable toilets, mixed martial arts? You also had something about a mail sorting. There was just this whole sort of potpourri dentistry. And somehow you looked at all these different sort of individual areas, and yet you saw monopoly there. And I'm like, how is that even possible? So let me welcome you to the program. And I want my audience to take a piece of paper out and write down a couple of things. I want them to sort of write words like add-ons, multiple expansion, roll up, because we're not talking like food, like a roll mop. We're talking about a roll up. So welcome to the program and walk us through how you started looking at these sort of very basic services that people sort of see, not in the sort of monopolistic way, but in a way that just says, wow, I need a porta potty. How come I can't get one? And when did it go up in price? it was a great way of looking at the politics of monopoly.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, so I'm not old, but I've been around for a while. And one of the things that I've kind of noticed in my lifetime, particularly over the last 15 to 20 years, is how everything is kind of getting a little bit worse, kind of every day, I don't mean, moral morality. I just mean sort of like everything is increasingly difficult, dealing with gift cards or dealing with like the institutions that you buy cable from, or, it all kind of, there's more like automated phone trees. Everything gets a little bit more annoying every day. And it seems hard to identify, kind of like punching clouds. And I'm sort of trying to figure out, why is this? Why is it just like, filling out forms for HR, like just kind of annoying things, right? And a couple of years ago, I was at, I had a back problem, and I was at a physical therapist who was she's just great. And she explained to me what was going on in the physical therapy market, where she said, physical therapy, there's no economies of scale. It's all just a bunch of people that own their own little shop, and they get reimbursements from health insurance companies. But what's happening right now is the health insurers, there's so much concentration in that market that they've just decided to reduce reimbursements for us. So it makes us harder to do business. And then there's this guy who runs a private equity firm, which is basically, it's a fund that just with a bunch of money and they can buy and just take control of businesses, that he's going around and just sort of pressuring all of these physical therapists to sell them their practice in this particular region. And that way they'll have more bargaining leverage against insurance companies, right? And then what ends up happening is physical therapists become corporatized. They are no longer independent business people who can sort of take care of patients and say, are you feeling pain? If not, if you are, here's what to do. Instead, they become much more oriented around checklists by this private equity guy who's just trying to generate more revenue. And I really liked my physical therapist, but if the trend keeps going the way it is, she won't be there for very much longer. When I heard about this, it was really interesting because I was like, oh, this is happening in a lot of different industries where you just see this kind of combination of market pressure from concentrated monopoly power. And then these funds, which are called private equity funds, and they go and they just buy up to try to accumulate market power. That's changing the shape of lots of different industries. And so the piece that I wrote is one where I just looked into a bunch of different industries where these funds, which are just people on Wall Street who collect money from our pensions and then try to exploit market power, what they're doing. And so I looked at the portable toilet industry. So there's a company called United Site Services, which is run by a billionaire who owns the Detroit Pistons, and his firm is called, I think, Platinum Equity Partners. He also has another company, which is an attempt to corner the market on prison phone services. Now, when a private equity firm buys a company in a market, and then it comes and it tries to buy companies that are competitors in that market. So buys a physical therapy firm and then buys another one in the same region and is trying to assemble a whole kind of empire of that same line of business. That's called a roll-up. So that's a term that people use in the private equity industry. Sometimes when you buy a company that's in the same industry, it's called an add-on. There are a bunch of different names for it. Private equity is a significant part of our banking system at this point. So that's how a lot of companies now get money, is they solicit private equity investment. Private equity is a specific form of capital allocation, which allows the banker to also take control of the company and accumulate market power, extract extra revenue, oftentimes cut corners in ways that are sort of fraudulent. So another area I looked at was dentistry, where you're seeing a lot of dentist practices being bought up. And then what ends up happening is these corporate dentistry chains will defraud Medicare or Medicaid. And, you sort of go on and on. I forget, there's just a number of others. But, you see monopolies kind of in almost every area of American life. And they make our lives as customers, as workers, and as people who live in communities. They might make our lives a little worse every day.
So let me just read a sentence back to you that caught my eye, because we're talking about private equity with the roll-ups and the add-ons and the expansions, whatever. And so their goal is just, I feel like they're like a Pac-Man. They just keep grabbing whatever's around. And this is their way of arguing that we'll create this greater efficiency. We're going to give you, you know, we're going to have greater market shares. So we're going to reduce prices. Of course, a lot of those things never happen. And you write, would-be monopolists aren't actually very good at the underlying business, but they are excellent at financial sort of engineering. So they know how to sell what they're doing. They just don't know how to do the business that they're buying. And that's another, I think, problem is that, you know, when it's your dentist and your dentist owns the business, they have sweat in the game. They have equity in the game. This is their company. And they have a relationship with you also with the integrity of who they are. And that's true with your physical therapist. That's true with almost everyone else. And once you're sold out to something, then that idea that it's yours, one, disappears. And I feel like you're absolutely right. You start, you know, having to comply with a checklist, but that's not why you went into the business. You didn't go into physical therapy to sign off on a checklist. You went into physical therapy to help your client.
Right. You know, that's such an important part of the dynamic that we're dealing with. The American tradition of equality, which I probably Richard talked about somewhat, is sort of this idea of republicanism. Going back to the 19th century, the 18th century, just a little piece of property. Everybody gets a little piece of property. Always romanticized, but that was the sort of the gist of it. Because, you know, this sort of the same expression you hear, nobody ever washed or rented car. Right? You just sort of take care of your own property a little bit better than you would if it's someone else's. And then another way of putting that in a more corporatized form is the concept of absentee ownership. So the idea that if you are an absentee landlord or if you're far away from the possessions that you control, you don't really take care of them. And that's what a lot of monopolization is about. It's also what private equity is about. It's about separating control from responsibility. Now, just to explain, monopoly and private equity are slightly different, although they definitely intersect. So monopolization is just acquiring market power in a specific market for goods and services. It doesn't have to be a particular ownership structure. It could just, you know, be rolling up the whole industry or acquiring that whole industry. You know, Google's not owned by private equity. It has a search monopoly. Private equity is an attempt to buy companies and then extract enough money from either dividends or by selling them later to make a profit. And sometimes it means buying a company and then buying a bunch of other companies in that industry and combining them together and then selling that for more money later. That's not always about monopolization. Sometimes, like, for example, with porta potties, they United Site Services is not a monopoly, although they're trying to become one. It's also sometimes a game of financialization. So that would be, you know, right now, if you have a small company that's run by a family, typically, it will sell, it's worth 3 to 4 times the overall cash flow, so the amount of cash it generates a year. Right. And you take a bunch of those companies and you combine them together into something that's much bigger, and you spin this story to investors, oh, I don't have just portable toilets, this is a sanitation platform, right? If you just tell a different story, use the platform words or all of these gibberish words that investors love, you can sell it for 8 to 9 times cash flow. So that's one way of saying, you know, and you can juice the cash flow returns a little bit if you reduce investment or if you raise prices here or there, if you commit a little fraud. And so it's a really easy way of driving short-term gains really quickly. And it's not about actually doing a better job in the underlying business. So
that's what I was going to, let me just ask you. So I actually see that there may be a little more virtue, if there's possible to say that, with a monopoly than there is to private equity buying something. Because private equity doesn't have any real concern. Private equity is about draining whatever equity is in it, or about gaining whatever profit share or whatever in order to sell it, or, you know, package it with the idea that you can sell it for 8 times more as opposed to 2 to 3 times more. At least maybe with monopoly, I get a kind of sense of, at least there's kind of a commitment to whatever it is you've monopolized. I mean, you still want to make good steel. Or you still want to make, I mean, I just, I don't know if I'm big making.
No, it makes sense. It's kind of like comparing different Disney villains, right? Or maybe a better way to put it. Happy family is happy in the same way. Every unhappy family is different, right? So sometimes there are monopolies that are not that bad. And sometimes there's private equity firms that are actually quite helpful. You know, private equity is just a form of investment. It doesn't necessarily, you know, the smaller firms are usually pretty good. What makes private equity problematic is that they can borrow money. First of all, it's the monopolization, which they shouldn't be able to do. That's just a monopoly problem. But second of all, they can borrow a bunch of money to buy portfolio companies, and then they can extract all sorts of fees from those companies without improving the services or benefits. Yes. And so it's not so much that the investing, you know, investment's just investment, capital allocation is just capital allocation. It's the ability to separate ownership and control. So a different way to do investment would be, you know, if you just have a bank that lends and they're not in control of the company, but they have influence because they are lending. But, you know, that's sort of a different model. And then they have to do real credit analysis. They're not looting the company. Some private equity firms don't loot companies. Some of them, they have strategies where, you know, there are smaller ones, especially smaller ones, where they are like, oh, well, this firm needs some capital and we think it's a good opportunity. And they put some money in and the company grows and then they sell it later on. And that's fine. It's really the ones that are borrowing lots of money, what are called leverage buyout shops, whose goal is to just be predatory and monopolize. And that's the problem. And those are the bigger ones. Those are the big guys.
Okay. So now that I know that there's some good private equity and there's some decent concepts of maybe monopoly and whatever, what I'm trying to figure out is, so how do you distinguish between the good private equity and the bad private equity? How do you put some rules for the road so that the kind of private equity that you've just been describing that basically loots companies, doesn't make investments, are there basically to sort of pull out whatever finances is and then leave this hollow shell? Do you write legislation that stops?
Yeah, you write legislation. I mean, it's conceptually not that complicated.
All right,
the difference is good private equity is premised on helping companies become better and more efficient, produce better products. Bad private equity is premised on financial engineering.
How do you write a piece of legislation that says, this is the kind of good behavior you have to exercise. This is the bad behavior. Anyone ever written legislation like this?
There's a couple of different ways, things that you need to do. So I would say three. And this is from Eileen Applebaum, who's an economist.
I know Eileen.
So first, what you say right now, if you buy a portfolio company and you're a private equity firm, and that portfolio company goes bankrupt, you're not responsible for the debt. That debt gets written off and the creditors lose, but you're not responsible for it. However, if that company does well, you get to keep the equity that you gain or you get to pull dividends out. That's a really serious problem. So just make the debt that you're, if you own a portfolio company,
you
and
own
that
it.
Portfolio borrows money, you, the owner, are jointly liable for that debt. Pretty simple. That way, if the company goes—
Seems fair.
Yeah, you're put the billionaires on the hook for the debt that they borrow through limited liability corporations. If you did that, you would get rid of a lot of the looting, right? One way to understand private equity is it's kind of like a legal version of gangsters burning down the restaurant for the insurance money, right? If you just don't get them the insurance money, there's no incentive to burn down the restaurant, right? So that's one thing that you could do.
Let me just ask a question. We have to write a law for this? This is legal? I mean, to me, I mean, I just keep seeing the virtue of, you know, I've got skin in the game. This is my, I mean, I'm hearing all the things that I hear from like my business brother friends. And, you know, the idea is that they're so virtuous, they're making this investment, they're taking on this burden. But what I'm hearing from you is you can actually write a deal where there is no downside. The only thing that happens is you're there to pick up on the upside.
Right. That's right. You have to make the debt, you know, you make that jointly liable for the general partners.
Right.
How can that not be the case in general
contract
liability unless it's written into other contracts? For instance, if I'm selling widgets to this company and this company is partly owned by or totally owned by this private equity firm, Bain Capital or whatever, why isn't Bain Capital liable for the debt if the underlying company doesn't pay me for my widget?
It's just not. Because it's not required to be, and lenders don't put that in their covenants. So there's no requirement for that. And we just put that in law saying you can't, you know, if you own a company, it's part of your conglomerate and you're liable for it.
So is this what Elizabeth Warren means? I mean, she talks a lot about corruption. She's talked a lot about, so when, you know, I know she's had a plan for this, but now I have so many more questions of her having talked to both you and Richard than I had before. So as she's been rolling out the plans, and some of those plans I think are also sort of coming out of the mouth of Joe Biden, are there suggestions for the kind of rules of the game that we need? Will this require legislation?
Yeah,
Is this done through regulatory enforcement? Is this done through executive order? How do we actually begin to see a system that creates more of a level playing field and says, you know, it's great that you're making the investment, but guess what? You own both the positive as well as the negative.
Yeah, so let me just run through a couple of the other things you would need to do to address it. So it's joint liability for debts. The second is you should force them to pay severance for workers they fire, right? If a private equity firm takes over a portfolio company and fires a bunch of people, they should have to pay severance. That way there's less of an incentive to just loot, just go in and just fire a bunch of people to generate a short cash flow boost and then flip it later. So that's number two. Number three, there should be a lot more transparency for fees for investors, because the investors, particularly pension funds, often don't know what they're actually being charged. And that's a big problem. And it allows the looting kind of private equity instead of just good investment. And then the fourth, and this isn't private equity specific, but it would be reinvigorating antitrust laws. And that would address a lot of the roll-up type of arrangements, and because then you wouldn't be able to do that. So you'd have to find, you know, places to invest that's not about acquiring market power, but are about creating better products and services. So if you did those four things, you would take care of this problem. And this is essentially a form of large-scale cheating going on across the economy.
So as we're looking at some of those things you're talking about, for example, the roll-ups, there's a way for you to begin to... So now my question is, how many roll-ups are too many? Where do we put the line of demarcation? And I mean, I feel like that's what we used to do that with the media, remember? With, right. You know, you could only own so many newspapers in right. a certain region. You could only own so many TV. Yeah. Well, that's bull. Because that's completely sort of evaporated.
They got rid of that in the 96 Telecom Act. I mean, that's a lot of the media. And so I think you need to reimpose a lot of these rules, you know, new legislation or new regulatory choices or antitrust suits. And some of the laws are still on the books that you can use. Yeah, I mean, what we need is we need to start governing private power again. And that's kind of what Richard and I are going to be teaching, you know, this next semester is how did Americans used to conceptualize the role of the state and democracy? And the way that Americans used to understand politics is as a mechanism to constrain coercive governing power, whether that power was public or private. So a lot of the arguments about the private sector versus the public sector, that wouldn't make any sense in the 19th century. The corporate charter was a grant of sovereign authority. And so, of course, the state should have an important role in regulating that. And then we've sort of reinterpreted the 19th century to mean this kind of libertarian ethos, like that's what we didn't really regulate anything, which is completely not true. And so now we kind of today, we just sort of accept that private equity is a legitimate business model, that there's very little the state can do, that antitrust is really hard. And all of that, the presumption there is that there is this private sector that we must leave alone, instead of there's just a bunch of corporations, all of which are effectively grants of sovereign power. So we the people have important interest in structuring how they operate.
So one of the things I was reading in Richard John's material was, how did this become right-left? How did this become conservative and liberal? Because what I'm hearing from you is, you know, historically, when I think of some of my conservative friends, they would value what you were just talking about. When I'm listening to my liberal friends, I mean, they want more of a level playing field. They want transparency. They don't want someone to come in and basically sort of, you know, take all the equity out and then leave a shell. I mean, how did this become right-left?
I don't think it's right left. I think that if you want to be pessimistic, I think neither party's for it. If you want to be optimistic, you could say both parties are becoming more interested in it. So I think that you definitely have a lot of people on the right who are intrigued by these questions because they're afraid of big tech. And you definitely have a lot of people on the left that are intrigued by the problem because they feel that there's something, capitalism is out of control. So there's definitely a lot of interest. You're seeing a lot of investigations, particularly of big tech, but you know, more and more discussion of private equity. And it's just sort of a question of when are we going to be able to work through our politics to constrain these institutions? As you said, we have to rebuild. What does that mean?
The distinction less light left and more whether we're actually producing a good, yeah. producing something as opposed to whether we're just financiers who are playing with the money and not really making any, contributing anything to society, but we're lining our pockets with profit.
Yeah, that's another way of putting it is a consumer-oriented versus a producer-oriented mindset. So the labor theory of value that goes back hundreds of years versus the, you know, sovereign consumer theory, which also descended from aristocracy. So those are just different ways of talking about the same problems we've always faced.
So one of the big mantras I always have is, what's an economy for? And is it an economy just for the 1% or is the economy for all of us? And as I'm hearing this, I think that's a little bit about what we're talking about. Because if you sort of see this sort of sucking sound and you see job loss and you see the hollowing out of companies and you see the frustration as you were talking about whenever you wanted to buy a product, it was just getting more difficult. You have to start asking yourself, what's an economy for? You know, if the 1% are bankrolled, that's fine. But if the rest of us are in a situation where we're not only dissatisfied, but we may be unemployed, and we may, you know, find out that everything that we're trying to purchase is now costing more money, and we're not getting anything more of value. There's no value to what's happening here. That's a reason to sort of want to see the situation change. And I guess maybe that's one of my questions. And before I let you go, I used to be on the National Board of Common Cause. And the reason I was on the National Board of Common Cause was I saw the idea of money and politics. And as I'm listening to you talk about the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, I think you're absolutely right. They both got bought, you know, and they wanted to sort of massage what bought them because they wanted to stay in power. Can we get to any of the things you talk about without creating that disconnect between money and politics?
Yeah, I'm less of a, I agree with you that there's a huge problem with corruption and a lot of the actors are bought off. But I also don't think that it's purely about buying people off. I think a lot of this is intellectual. I think Americans have lost their sense of what it means to be American and how to constrain power. And that's they're regaining it. I mean, they're starting to we're trying to recenter political economy as the point of politics. And I think you're starting to see people kind of glom onto that. And ultimately, political leaders do follow their voters. And I think the voters are changing their mindset. I mean, they see it. We all see it around us. This isn't rocket science, and you can't ultimately buy off a society the way that we have without mass anger and a loss of legitimacy. So that's what we're seeing right now.
So Matt Stoller is a director of research at the American Economic Liberties Project. Prior to joining AELP, he was a fellow at the Center of Open Markets Program. He has a fabulous site called Big. He is the author of the book, Goliath, the 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy. So I'm going to end with this. Let's say Joe Biden wins. Does Joe Biden become the moment? Is the moment changing? Do we see that he has the capacity? I always say that he leads from behind. I've been saying this for months now, and people kind of look at me and roll their eyes. But I'm wondering, as you're talking about the fact that the American people are beginning to sort of recognize or establish the kind of things they want to value, is Joe capable of recognizing that too?
I don't think so. I don't know. I should say that. So I don't think so. I do think that there's a kind of open question about whether the Republican or Democratic Party gets there first in terms of addressing corporate power. I don't really know who's going to get there first. I know there's going to be battles on both sides. It's hard for me to see Joe Biden getting there. I mean, it's possible, but the inspiring thing is that it really has to come from the people. And I think that the people are getting, Biden yes. can't be pushed there, but he's not going to go there on his own. So
no.
Like, I don't think he'll get there, but maybe he could. You know, I'm not as pessimistic about him as I was about Obama, for instance.
Oh, well, on that note, Matt Stoller, please join us again. Check out his site, Big, and of course, go buy his book, Goliath. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
All right, this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.